So what if I told you the Catholic Church once, like, legally authorized you to break its own laws if you were in a hurry?
I mean, it sounds completely counterintuitive.
Yeah, it sounds like a total joke. But in 1215, that was actually just one of the 71 constitutions passed during the Fourth Lateran Council. We're doing an exploration into the source material today that reveals how this one meeting in Rome effectively became the G8 summit of the Middle Ages.
Right, and our mission here is really to figure out how Pope Innocent III and, well, about 1,200 prelates created a legal system that still dictates how we think about things like consent, voting, and even self-defense today.
And when we say prelates, we basically just mean high-ranking church officials like bishops and abbots. But jumping right in, it's the sheer scale of the ambition here that's fascinating. Innocent III wasn't just interested in theology, right?
No, not at all. He was genuinely obsessed with legal precision. He was building on the work of his predecessor, Alexander III, trying to solve a very messy problem, which is, how do you make a group decision when everyone is actively fighting?
Exactly, yeah. And they came up with this rule called the maior et senior pars, the greater and wiser part.
Right.
But okay, hold on. Greater and wiser, because that honestly sounds like a recipe for a rigged election. If I'm the one in power, I'm obviously going to say my supporters are the wiser ones.
Oh, for sure.
So who actually decided who the smart people were?
Well, that was the catch, really. It wasn't a simple head count where 51% just automatically wins. The council argued that the quality of the voters mattered just as much as the quantity.
Right, like they were trying to balance democracy with meritocracy.
Exactly. It's why today, we don't just let a random crowd decide a court case. We use a curated jury or a board of directors. They were moving away from the chaos of whoever screams loudest to a system where authority and merit actually carried legal weight.
So it's less about one man, one vote, and more about like one expert, 10 votes. But they weren't just focused on these high-level elections. They were getting into the nitty-gritty of your personal life too, specifically who you were allowed to marry.
Yeah, which was a huge deal. Before this, you couldn't marry anyone within 7 degrees of relation.
Which just sounds like a mathematical nightmare because if you lived in a small medieval village, by the time you got to 7 degrees, basically everyone was your cousin.
Literally everyone.
Right. You were committing accidental incest just by getting married.
Yeah, and the council slashed that down to 4 degrees. I mean, it was a very practical solution to a legal crisis that was keeping half of Europe in a state of perpetual sin.
But then they introduced that get out of jail free card I mentioned earlier, the necessitas non habet legem. Necessity knows no law.
Right.
Like if I'm a priest traveling through a war zone or a famine-stricken village, I can just ignore the rules. That sounds like an invitation for everyone to claim an emergency whenever they want to cut corners.
I get why it sounds that way, but it's less of a loophole and more of a safety valve. Think about a priest during a famine who steals bread to feed the starving, or maybe a bishop who has to perform a ritual in an unsanctified place because of an invading army.
So Innocent III was basically just acknowledging that the world is messy.
Yeah, exactly. He was codifying the idea of extraordinary circumstances. It's actually the direct ancestor of our modern legal defense of necessity. Like breaking a window to save someone from a burning building.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting that the same council that gave individuals a necessity loophole was also grappling with the necessity of the church itself, especially when addressing the fallout from the Fourth Crusade.
Oh, yeah, where Latin and Greek Christians were basically at each other's throats.
Right. And the council's official stance was that the church abhors blood, yet they solidified a rite called vim vi repellere, meaning repelling force with force.
Yeah, this is essentially the legal birth of clerical self-defense. The logic was that while a priest shouldn't be a man of blood who initiates a fight, he definitely shouldn't be a victim either.
Sort of reconciling the biblical command to turn the other cheek with the natural law of survival.
Exactly. But that tension between the East and West, it went way deeper than just physical safety. It actually got down to the very chemistry of their rituals.
You were talking about the altar washing controversy. Our sources describe Greek priests literally scrubbing down their altars after Latin priests used them.
Which is wild.
It really is. I mean, it sounds like a petty neighbor dispute, but it was actually this massive legal rejection.
Because it wasn't about hygiene at all. It was about the bread. The Latins used unleavened bread, while the Greeks used leavened. And to the Greeks, using unleavened bread was this Judaizing error. It was spiritually dead to them.
Oh, wow. So by washing the altar, they were saying the Latin presence was basically a pollutant.
Exactly. It was their way of using a highly physical act to declare that Roman authority had zero legal standing in their churches.
It's just incredible to think that these decrees, from the wiser part voting to the necessity rule, they stayed on the books until 1917. They really were the scaffolding for how the West thinks about the rights of the individual versus the group.
Yeah, it reminds us that law isn't just some list of prohibitions. It's an attempt to create a map for human behavior in a world that, quite frankly, rarely follows the rules.
Totally. So next time you're trying to talk your way out of a late fee or a traffic ticket by claiming extenuating circumstances, just remember you're actually using a 13th century legal loophole designed for medieval monks. But it leaves me with one final thought. If the law grants us the right to repel force with force, at what point does your defense turn into an offense? Like, where do you actually draw the line between protecting your space and becoming a crusader in your own life? Definitely something to think about.